So I want to talk to you about dead systems, legacy systems. And I'm going to start with a story. So you'll remember terminals. You've probably used them in the past, if you're old enough, I guess, or at least you've seen them. But wait one sec. Can you just click or something? Because this doesn't seem to work. Nope, wrong way. Back. Down. The other down. Down, down, down. Yay! Okay. But not exactly what I meant. So I'll just roll with it. Anyway, so could you go down? It's like down? Yeah. Just follow the lines. Great. So many years ago, that was my first computer, the IBM XT. It had 1 megabyte of RAM, which basically means the bus of the memory was 20 bit wide. And it had kind of a quirk because the CPU was 16-bit. Okay, so in order to use pointers, 16-bit pointers with a 20-bit memory bus, what they did is they used two addresses, two 16-bit addresses, and one was for the segment, one was for the offset into the segment, and because of that, you actually had 32 bits, so that means that you actually had a modulo. So you had some overlap, and that meant that they had a quirk where when you went over the offset, over the 16-bit that you were allowed, you wrapped around back to zero, which was kind of cool. And MS-DOS and a lot of other software used that. But when the 8286 computer, the ATS, arrived, it had 24 bits of a memory bus, so 16 megabytes of RAM, so it actually needed to use the upper addresses. So the problem was compatibility. Like, because MS-DOS actually used the wraparound behavior, that behavior had to be preserved. But still, you needed access to the upper address space. So what do you do? Could you just click again? Thank you. Or I'll just continue, whatever. Anyway, what they did is they introduced something called the 820 gate. So the 820 gate was basically when you sent an interrupt, it switched from one mode, from real mode, as we call it today, to protected mode. And you can actually see this is from the master branch of the Linux kernel, still active today. And on every boot, we send an interrupt to switch from real mode to protected mode. Do you know where do we send the interrupt? I don't know if you can see this on over there. We send it to the keyboard controller. I shit you not. Why do we do that? So IBM had a spare pin on the keyboard controller, and they were like, why don't we use this to control the 820 gate? And it seemed like a good idea because no one thought about standardization at the time. So they kind of did that. And today, on every boot, what we do is we send an interrupt to the keyboard controller to a pin that no longer exists to switch from real mode to protected mode. Yes, this is true. Hit it. Again, thank you. Please. Yeah. So I don't know if you remember this. This is a terminal. I've used one. All of you still use something like that. We actually use something called a pseudo-terminal, which is the way we SSH. So fun fact, this is a protocol that is 40 years old, you know, for VMS and stuff, but it's actually based on a 19th century protocol for teletype, the stock ticker. So we're using a 19th century piece of software, I guess, if you can call it that, even today, which is why it's so hard to use callers and stuff like that in the terminal, because it's very, very, very absolute. But this is also a terminal. The graphical systems in use in modern Linuxes, anyway, they are also a terminal. They work the following way. It's basically what we call X Windows. It's from 1984. And you have an application, which is an X client. It talks to keyboard and keyboard video mouse services, which is the X server, and they communicate over a network, which is why gaming on Linux is so shitty, because you know it's all basically remote. It has a nice feature. You can run a remote desktop or remote application on X, but it's very, very slow, and yes, it's still used on modern Linux machines. I checked yesterday, it's still operational on on Ubuntu 18.04. So yeah, that's kind of a bummer. So you might think to yourselves, this is really, really weird, but yeah, maybe it's not so bad. it is so bad. You remember this? Intel Pro? You know what's really quirky about that specific processor? So a very, very long time ago, there were two competing architectures for CPUs, the CISC and RISC. CISC was basically complex instruction set, you know, very rich, a lot of instructions, about 160 instructions, got extended over the years. Very, very helpful if you want to program in assembly. And Intel, which eventually won those wars, they sold very cheap x86 CISC chips. On the other hand, you had RISC, which is a reduced instruction set, very small instruction set, very low level, not a lot of fun to program with if you program with assembly, but very easy to optimize and very, very fast. And all the high-end CPUs, they used RISC. But Intel won. They won the market, and by the mid-90s, you know, Intel basically moved everyone to CISC, and everyone was using the x86 instruction set. So we had a lot of software that was compiled for Intel, but Intel actually wanted to move to RISC because RISC was actually better in many ways. They could optimize it better. They could manufacture devices that utilized RISC and parallelized it and so on and so on and so on. They actually shipped a processor, the Itanium architecture, that was completely RISC-based, and it never took off. It failed in the marketplace, and you know, no one actually used that. Well, maybe some people did, but not a lot of people. So guess what they did when they wanted to move to RISC? You want to take a guess? Yes. All of our processors use RISC internally. And the CISC that we use, the x86 assembly, gets interpreted and compiled on the fly back to RISC. So, I mean, it's kind of weird, and you know, it's really, really bizarre and wasteful, I would say, but it does have some advantages. For example, now you can patch a processor by changing the interpreter, which is kind of cool, I guess, but I don't think that anybody meant for that to happen. Hit it again? So those are examples of the stuff, the legacy that we still carry today, you know, 40 years even after, 150 years later, stuff that got stuck in our systems and we can't ever, ever get rid of it. You think that's bad, but you can actually see it everywhere. QWERTY, horrible layout, we use it everywhere, we can't get rid of it. TAL, we no longer have tapes, we still have the tape archive. Yay. DNS, email, horrible architecture, horrible protocol, insecure, lots of problems, we can't get rid of it. That's the problem. Anyone knows what CRLF is? Carriage return, line feed. Caps lock? You know what caps lock is? There was actually a weight, a physical weight, pulling the tape so you can print capital letters. Why do we still have caps locks? I don't know. Vim users usually remap it to escape. So I guess that's a feature if you want. So yeah. You think that's bad, but actually, it's not. We have airplanes that are legacy. When a brand new airplane, is being shipped, it's already legacy because it takes 5 to 10 years to design it, another 5 years to build it. By the time you fly on it, it's already deprecated completely. SMS, that started out as a hack in the 80s. We use it for authentication nowadays. Great. Credit cards? So in Israel, we still use the magnetic thing for credit cards. Horrible. And nuclear missiles. Yes. I'm going to go back to that one. I don't know if anyone thought about this, but we now have voice over IP running over DSL over analog phone lines to carry voice. This makes no sense. No sense at all. And I wasn't kidding about the nuclear missiles. This is from 2016, and this disk over there is not the 5-inch disk, by the way. This is the 8-inch disk that holds 250 kilobytes of data. Yeah, so definitely horrible. So how the hell did this happen? Every one of us, at some point, maybe 10 or 20 years ago, worked at a company and probably did a very good job. And when you do a very good job, something marvelous happens. Everyone goes like, oh, this works. Don't ever touch it. Right? So 10 years later, you bump into someone from that company in a conference, and they're like, so you're that guy. I was like, okay, what? Turns out your system is still running, and you're like, no way you're still running that thing. I never intended for this to run for 10 years, let alone, you know, 20. Actually, I thought this would be up for like maybe half a year until someone else brought, you know, this permanent system that is supposed to replace this temporary hack that I've put in. Yet no one did, because you did your job too well. So I guess the only way to avoid it is just do a shitty job. That's one way. Or if you happen to do a good job and you want to keep your job, maybe think about deprecation. Could you press that thing? Thank you. So if you're doing infrastructure, as most of us do, you have to remember that infrastructure stays forever. Basically sets the ground, sets the protocols, the expectations. And if it's a physical infrastructure, like credit cards, they have those physical devices where you swipe the card, it's a logistic nightmare. Sometimes you can't replace them. You can't go around the world. You can't replace all the phone lines. You can't replace all the devices. So it's a problem. But today, we can build hardware that has software that we can update. So it's kind of better if you remember to think about that. And of course, everyone who ever shipped a router to someone's home have thought about remote upgrades, right? Which is why IoT is so amazing. So don't do that. Protocols, that's another really big problem because of the network effect. Basically, if I can't talk to you, then you don't want to, you have no incentive of using the protocol, and I don't have an incentive using the protocol. So let's think about a telephony system or radio system or whatever. The problem with upgrading such a system is I have no incentive to upgrade if everyone doesn't upgrade. So what do we do? No one has an incentive to upgrade. It's kind of, one of those game theory questions, except it's a really big problem. So standards help. Unfortunately, not everyone thinks about standards, because I'm sure the WhatsApp protocol, for example, that has to be a standard, right? Not so much. So think about deprecation. This is something that we all pretend that doesn't exist, right? No one wants to think about their own mortality, about stuff having to end, about their software being deleted or removed. So usually you don't have a deprecation plan. It's never a feature. I've never seen a product plan where there was a feature named deprecation. Never ever seen this. And even if you do have a plan for deprecation, what if the third parties refuse to deprecate it? For example, we have middle boxes, routers on the internet, and maybe we want to deprecate the HTTP 1 protocol, but if the CDNs don't agree, if the browsers don't agree, not much we can do about it. So when you go back to your job, please, please, please think about deprecation. Think about how to avoid building another legacy system. Build deprecatable systems, or at least upgradable systems. Yes, we can upgrade systems to some degree if we think about it upfront. One of the nice things about protocols like HTTP is that they survived so many years because they were extensible. We could extend them. And this is how we got nice features, despite the fact that we're using a protocol that was never designed to do the stuff that it's doing today. Unfortunately, every good thing must come to an end, including this conference, which was amazing. So when you think about your system, remember, it too will die at some point. Have a deprecation plan. If you are designing protocols, make sure they are extensible. Make sure that your data systems have some way of exporting the data to a new system. Remember that as long as the system is active, it needs to be maintained. And think about whether your system is going to be upgradable or replaceable. If you cannot replace it, it has to be upgradable. So thank you very much. By the way, I took that photo on the plane on the way here. You would notice that although you're not allowed to smoke, there's still an ashtray on every plane. This is mandated by the FAA, by the way. Okay? Thank you.